From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. The presidential runoff election in Zimbabwe is scheduled for 2 weeks from now, but nothing about the country's election process has been simple. In March, Zimbabweans went to vote on whether to keep President Robert Mugabe in power or to elect one of the challengers. President Mugabe and his ZANU-PF party have held power since independence in 1980. An opposition leader, Morgan Tsvangirai, of the Movement for Democratic Change, has been his main challenger in recent elections. The government said the first round of elections didn't produce a majority. That meant a runoff, but since the runoff plan was announced, locals have died or been beaten in election-related violence. International reporters and diplomats have been detained or expelled. Food aid for malnourished people has reportedly been confiscated by the government, and Tsvangirai has faced threats and government detention during his campaigning. In fact, Tsvangirai was just released hours ago from yet another detention. We spoke with the Zimbabwean opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai shortly before his latest detention. He shared his perspective on the election and told us about the work he's doing with the American-based media outlet MTVU. You have stood for election, seen that the government says that you did not win a majority, been detained, waited for a runoff. What was the moment when you most despaired during this process of the election and the post-election?
I think the most despairing moment was the waiting for the results, when we knew that we had won the election and that that the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission was not announcing the result. I think it was the worst moment of waiting.
How do you think the MDC supporters are doing right now? Have people... There have been widespread beatings, detentions. Do you think that people are still willing, whenever the runoff actually happens, to go out and vote? Or are some people going to be too afraid?
I'm quite confident that the people will reaffirm their vote on the 29th of March. However, you have to appreciate the hostile environment in which everyone has to operate in terms of those violent behavior of the regime. And so as we go towards this election, they also know that they've got the country's destiny in their hands, in which case that they have an obligation to reaffirm their vote of the 29th of March, because that's the only way in which they can turn over a new leaf.
There's reports that in some of the rural areas, there's so little food. And not only for people to have to deal with election-related violence, but what has been an ongoing era of food shortages, sometimes of drought. People are dealing with so much right now, the currency devaluation, which is so out of control. What do you find when you go to the rural areas that people hope for the future?
Well, the hope of the people is really to see this change so that they can start to reverse all the misfortunes they've experienced under this regime. They see any change bringing in a new, better life, a new Zimbabwe emerging out of that change. Anything is better than what is taking place today.
Give me an example of a conversation you've had with one of your young supporters, maybe someone who you just met while you were out on the road.
Well, I was out on the road in Matabeleland, for instance. It's normally a dry area, and from time to time is a food deficit. But this year is even more acute and despairing. Wherever I go, people say, look, my son, we've had enough of this. Old women are talking about we've had enough. We are suffering with no food and with nothing. Literally, the desperation is written on their faces. And when they see me, they just light up as if I'm bringing them anything. So that inspires me. Just recently, I went to a hospital where these young people have had severe beatings and they were suffering from broken arms and broken legs. And they said, President, come the 29th, I just hope that my wounds will heal so that I go back home and vote. We want to vote this man out. We cannot let go now. So I think those are the scenes sometimes I experience on a daily basis that inspires us to continue to go forward.
Now, clearly, you are opposed to Robert Mugabe as a political opponent, but also philosophically. But Zimbabwe gained its independence in 1980. It was one of the latest African countries to really shed the colonial shackles. President Mugabe was considered a hero by so many people. Knowing what you do now, do you see any good in him?
Robert Mugabe invokes these conflicting emotions. There are some who forgive him for what he has done after independence, which is horrendous and unforgivable. But there are others who also know Robert Mugabe as a patriotic Zimbabwean committed to the freedom of the people. So you do have that conflicting emotion. And I think that divide generationally between those who grew up with him and those who were born after independence. But I suppose the aspirations are different. And so you get those kind of emotions. And for me, I think that the first decade of independence, Robert Mugabe was my hero. I think he deteriorated, and I don't know what has made him to transform from a hero to a villain, and now to a real tyrant, and I think it's very unfortunate.
Do you think that these runoff elections are going to take place in a fair and timely manner?
Our hope is that the cessation of violence is imperative if there is to be some semblance of normalcy in the election. If this rate of violence continues, then certainly there's no way we can have a free and fair election. We are hoping that when the various delegations of observers start arriving, we may see a decline into these violent activities of the regime and its rogue elements.
You have worked now with MTV to do PSAs that call for a free and fair election. Why did you decide to work with MTV on this?
Well, you know that the background actually started as some form of informal conduct, then it developed into a conduct with a dispatch group. So Dispatch, which is a youthful band, staged a concert on Zimbabwe. And when I was in New York, I had a meeting with them, and that's how our relationship has developed.
Do you think that global youth, people not just in Zimbabwe, but, you know, in all the different places around the world that, for example, might plug into public service announcement like this, or just people who are young and listening to music and, you know, going online for their news, do you think that they can help advocate for the free and fair elections in Zimbabwe?
I think they will. It's not that because they love music, they just focus on music. I think they realize that the future is in their hands, and that what is affecting any part of the world affects them also. And I think that the youth are very conscious about the world in which they are living in. They are breaking boundaries between the developed and the underdeveloped, between races. They are the ones who are pathfinder in breaking these international barriers.
All right, let's turn back to this election. You're going to have a runoff, and if you get a majority of those votes, what do you think will happen? Do you think that you will be allowed to be declared the winner and take power, even if you win the majority?
Well, somebody said, you know, would you be allowed to get power? I said, look, to me, that's not the focus. It's not about power. It's about seeking a mandate from the people of Zimbabwe to believe in what we are trying to offer them. If some people believe that they will prevent that from happening, it's their choice, especially if they try to do it violently. I'm not a violent person, and therefore, that's why from the very base of the MDC, our commitment to nonviolent democratic change has been the focus of our values. So we'll not struggle with them. We'll just say, look, as far as we are concerned, we are the legitimate government. It's not about power struggle. It's about trying to do something about Zimbabwe.
Are you afraid that even if you take power, that people will quickly become disillusioned if their standard of living does not change? You have a situation now where...
I'm not God. I'm not God who says abracadabra and everything happens overnight. We have to work through the crisis, and we have to work through the trough. It's not going to be easy. We are going to exploit the amount of goodwill that the people have shown through the election to push through the certain reforms that are necessary to turn around this economy, turn around the misfortunes of the country. And we are going to make sure that we put all our efforts in trying to address some of the critical national questions that we will confront. But certainly to expect that after the change today, they will everything tomorrow will be unrealistic.
What do you want for Zimbabwe in terms of international partnerships? For example, China has made big inroads in Zimbabwe and throughout southern Africa in terms of building business interests. The U.S. and the U.K. have turned away while President Mugabe has been in office. What do you want to see in terms of international relations and international business partnerships?
I want Zimbabwe to be back again as part of the family of nations, especially of democratic nations. I want East and West, for the best interests of Zimbabwe, to be our foreign policy. We want our foreign policy to be based on our commercial interests, not on the warrior interests that Mugabe has pursued over the last 20 or 30 years. We are a small nation struggling to develop, had started off very well, but lost its way. And we want to restore that relationship with everyone. We don't want to be enemies to anyone. Perhaps the emphasis here is that we want to be friends to everyone and promote the interest, the commercial interests of Zimbabwe, the economic interests of Zimbabwe, because our people need economic restoration.
What about the Chinese arms shipment that almost made it to Zimbabwe? In a case like that, do you consider China just doing what it had to do, which is selling its goods, or were you disappointed that the Chinese government would send arms at such a critical moment in Zimbabwean democracy?
Well, I think that this is a diplomatic question. We will have to investigate what happened, what were the circumstances. But as far as I'm concerned, that I think it didn't serve the Zimbabwean interests very well for China to send us arms and not food. So I think that one has to examine this from a broader, long-term relationship, but I think you need to get the facts. For the moment, I think that the arms shipments indicate that they were supporting the government and not the people of Zimbabwe.
Finally, Mr. Tsvangirai, imagine that it is the year 2050. What is Zimbabwe like then?
In 2050, I think that the country would have moved from a developing country to a developed country. I think with all the aspects and all the indication benchmarks for a developed country by then.
Well, Mr. Tsvangirai, we hope we can talk to you again after the runoff election.
Thank you very much.
Morgan Tsvangirai is president of Zimbabwe's Movement for Democratic Change Party and a candidate for the nation's presidency. We tried to get a comment from Robert Mugabe, but the Zimbabwean embassy refused our request. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea.
Millions of Zimbabweans went to the polls in March to vote for a better future. But the outcome of the presidential election still hangs in the balance. And the ruling regime has unleashed a campaign of intimidation and violence against its own citizens. As the country heads towards a runoff vote, Zimbabweans are calling on the world to stop the human rights violations and ensure they can make a democratic choice. Choose or lose. Help Zimbabwe have a free and fair election on June 27th.
That was a public service announcement from MTVU, a 24-hour channel broadcast to universities across the country and around the world on the Internet. Earlier, we spoke with Zimbabwean opposition party leader Morgan Tsvangirai. He's been in and out of detention by Zimbabwe's government authorities. He was recently released from a two-hour detainment. As the opposition leader prepares for a runoff election, he's featured in these new MTVU public service announcements. The channel has worked on a number of online and on-air programs that try to connect its largely American audience to international issues. For more on MTVU's information campaign in Zimbabwe, we have Stephen Friedman, General Manager and Executive Vice President of MTVU. Welcome, Stephen.
Happy to be here.
So when we spoke with Mr. Tsvangirai, he said a couple of things about youth. One, he does think that efforts like this one to mobilize global youth for democracy work. And two, that Zimbabwean youth are critical in the election there. So tell us a little bit more about what you at MTV and MTVU are doing to sort of connect global youth in the service of democracy.
Sure. I think when we heard from Dispatch, the band, who had formed a relationship with Morgan Tsvangirai, they talked about what they were doing in terms of trying to ensure fair elections. And I think we've seen with our audience, whether it was years ago with the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa, and much more recently, our audience, college students in the U.S. in particular, have been really some of the loudest voices on the issue of Darfur and helping to stop the genocide in Darfur. And when we heard that he was interested in reaching out to young people, I think college students in general have been the real engine for a lot of the social change movements coming out of the U.S. And the idea that while we are here in the midst of an election, and are encouraging our audience certainly to get involved, the idea that one that could change really the face of Zimbabwe is playing out, and that there are being calls for free and fair elections, and I think we hope it will resonate with our audience, and that they will see that putting pressure on Mbeki or the SADC can potentially have a positive impact.
Tell us a little bit about Dispatch, this band that made this connection.
They have a huge college following. We had an intern that worked for us in New Orleans who introduced me to them several years ago, and they have a rabid following. And they did a sellout concert at Madison Square Garden a few several months ago, that was sold out within 30 minutes. So it speaks to the passion of their base. But interestingly, the money that they raised went to help the people in Zimbabwe and to help specifically ensure democracy in Zimbabwe. And historically, music has been a powerful tool for activism and for social movements. And it's inspiring when an opposition leader like Morgan Tsvangirai would reach out to a band like this.
Are you afraid that it seems partisan to work with an opposition leader but not with the sitting candidate for office?
You know, what we tried to do with the spots, and you can see them at MTVU.com, is make the case that this is not about any one candidate. It is about free and fair elections. And I think that given that we are not about encouraging people to vote, because only Zimbabweans can vote, it is more about ensuring that there are opportunities for free and fair elections.
You've done some really interesting, innovative, and unexpected work in terms of how you feature international content. You've had interactive games about Sudan. How do those work, and what do you think the target audience and the reaction has been?
You know, I think referring to our video game Darfur is Dying.
Right.
When we saw the audience, college students in particular, really passionate about saying never again. They had looked at Rwanda and looked at other examples of recent genocides, and they were speaking very loudly. But we felt like we needed to reach beyond the activists, and so much of our audience lives online. That game has now been played millions and millions of times and has generated tens of thousands of letters to public officials to do more. And I think the way this audience, young people today, they are reinventing activism online. And I think you're going to see this continuous morphing of what activism means. It's no longer just marching in the streets as it was when I was in college. I think it is not much more about taking over the digital space.
Stephen, thanks.
Thank you.
Stephen Friedman is the general manager and executive vice president of MTVU. As we grow up, most of us learn to distinguish what we call race, the set of visual and cultural cues we use to categorize people. Of course, race is, given our overall genetic diversity, a construct that we as humans have invented. But just because we invented it doesn't mean it isn't real. The way we think about race has shaped history, laws, dating and marriage, religion, the economy, just to name a few. But what about kids? How do they learn race and live race? A little bit later, we'll talk to an anthropologist who's working with teachers to help kids understand race. But first, we meet the mother of a preschooler and a toddler. Claire Jefferson Glipa joins me now. Claire, welcome.
Thank you.
So how did your daughter first discover, and we're talking about your preschooler, that she was Black and that it would shape her life in some way?
The first time she noticed that she was of brown skin in preschool was when her teacher asked her to draw a picture of herself and was given a white piece of paper and the standard color of crayons, just one shade of black, a shade of brown, and then red, yellow, green, and orange. And she realized there wasn't a color that represented her. She's more of a caramely mocha color, and that color just didn't represent her. So it was our first real discussion about what her skin looked like.
Now, when you talk to her, how sophisticated can you be at this stage in time? Because, you know, we have different realizations at different ages, and we have different language skills at different ages. So give me an example. If I were your daughter and I asked a question about why is this person looking like this and why is that person looking like that, what would you tell me?
Well, we are a family of faith, and so I use the term God in our home. And so I would tell her that, you know, God made you a beautiful color. He decided that you need to be a perfect brown. And so we mixed a little red, a little yellow, a little purple, and I would use it as we were working with maybe finger paints or something to create her particular color and talk about it in a celebratory way of how excited I was to have her and how excited God was to create her special color of brown.
Do you find that she has questions at this point, particularly about kids her age?
Definitely. I think for her, especially being a girl, right now Disney is huge in our society, and there are no princesses that look like her. So our largest conversations are around why she doesn't look like a princess, which is very sad. All of her friends, their backpacks, their clothing, their toys are all this wonderful representation of beauty that excludes her. And so it causes us to have that conversation quite often.
So when you're faced with that, how do you react? What kind of toys do you buy? What kind of messaging do you... You've talked about how you talk to her about how she's a child of God, but what else do you tell her in that context?
Well, first, we work really hard in our home to only have toys, books, and things that represent her. So in our home, we actually don't do Disney at all because of her exclusion. But what I do is we have wonderful discussions about princesses that really do exist. Princesses from Africa, princesses of Egypt, Zimbabwe, different actual ethnic princesses that exist. I find pictures of them, and we talk about how beautiful those real princesses are and what make them princesses are their power and not necessarily just what they look like.
How's what she's doing or going through different from the way that you faced these moments of awareness as a child yourself?
Well, I think the one exciting thing about this time is that things are available. I know when I was young, there were very few African-American Barbies even. I remember when the first African-American Barbie came out. I remember the first African-American Cabbage Patch Kid. And so there was those few things that we can cling to. Now there's a wealth of literature that I really can create a perfect world for her, at least in our home, of books and toys and media that she can see herself in and be excited about.
Do you ever worry, and this is something that many parents have to deal with, that you're creating a perfect world, and when she leaves that perfect world, she won't be prepared?
Well, I do, and that is the reason why I think I have the perfect world, so that her first feelings of herself are that there is nothing wrong with her and that she's perfect. As we begin, like as we start preschool and we're getting ready to start kindergarten, I do realize that we will begin having those conversations. And my hope and prayer is that that solid foundation that she has from her perfect world at home will allow her to combat whatever she comes up against in the world.
Later in our show, we're going to do our weekly letter segment, and we got someone who talked about Barack Obama in the context of being biracial. And the whole concept of biracial identity has become much more profound in recent years. Mm-hmm. How do you give words to your daughter about what or who she is?
Absolutely. I talk about my biggest conversations with her about all the parts of her and how it's just a perfect, beautiful mix that God created just for her that make her an amazing contribution to society. And without one piece of her, she would not be who she was. And so I think there's easy ways to just incorporate all of whatever a person, whether a child is African-American and Caucasian or even Asian and Caucasian or whatever mix that child is, there are wonderful words that you can use to make sure that they embrace all of who they are.
Well, Claire, we're going to bring another person into the conversation. Just to remind everybody, Claire Jefferson Glipa is the mother of a 4.5-year-old child, also a toddler, and she's a former teacher. Now joining us, we've got Yolanda Moses. She's Vice Provost for Diversity and Conflict Resolution and Professor of Anthropology at the University of California at Riverside. She is also the chair of a new project by the American Anthropological Association, which aims to help educators teach about race. Hi, Yolanda.
Hello.
So what do you think about the strategies Claire has? You know, what stands out to you?
Oh, I think Claire is just spot on. She is socializing her child to understand who she is in the context of a world that doesn't always recognize color in a positive way. And so because children are aware of who they are at, you know, 4 or 5 years old, it is important for them to have this positive self-concept because they will be encountering in their lives many, many examples that are not positive.
What do you think teachers can do, Yolanda, to help parents like Claire? Now, Claire happens to be a teacher herself,
right.
But, you know, but what about, you know, when you go into the classroom, every teacher's different, just like every person's different.
Right.
How should parents deal with teachers in schools?
Well, teachers are people themselves, and they are raised as well. We are all raised, socially raised. So sometimes the teachers don't know how to talk about the issue, even if they were well-meaning. They're not trained to talk about the issue, which is what our project gets at. That is an understanding of what race is and how to talk to students about race and have them engage in it. There's also the fear factor. Many people, teachers are afraid they may say the wrong thing, so they say nothing. But that silence goes a long way in sending messages to the children that either it's not important or it's off limits. And what we're trying to do is to change that, that it has to be engaged. It's a subject, as Claire has said, that is as normal as breathing, having students understand who they are.
Claire, you're a former teacher. When you were teaching, what did you do with your students?
Well, with my students, I taught sixth grade, so they can have quite a large vocabulary and discussion. We had a time where each student brought in not only things that represented their culture and their family, but we created a family tree as much as they could, and we had open discussions about what that meant for them each to be different, where they came from, even among African-American students, whether their family came from the North or South or actually immigrated from Africa itself.
Do you think that the kids appreciated that? I mean, regardless of what they got, and I'm sure they got a lot, do you think that they were like, oh, why are we talking about this? Or were they excited?
Well, sixth graders in and of themselves roll their eyes on a regular basis. So, I mean, anytime you introduce any subject. But what I did love is that it began a discussion on the playground. And that is where you know you have really hit a core with your students when you walk past them and there is no adult and they're still continuing the conversation on their own autonomously.
Yolanda, you know, how can you avoid being preachy about this in a way that kids tune out?
Well, I think if we understand that there are many dimensions to this thing we call race, we can make it a part of the educational process. That is, because it is a human invention, we can talk about that. Because it's been a part of the history of this country, we can talk about it as a history topic. And because we are biological beings, we can also talk about it as biology. So it isn't as though it sits off to the side and we only bring it in when we have to talk about these uncomfortable things. But we make it a part of how students learn to be in the world and to be a part of the world, the history as well as the biology as well as what's happening socially. And then you engage them by having them bring in their own experiences.
Claire, what's your greatest fear and your greatest hope? Just quickly, I know it's a big question for your kids.
I think my greatest fear is that my children will not stand in themselves and be proud of who they are and who they were created to be. My greatest hope is that they will be exactly who they choose to be, excited about what they look like, what they think like, and how they act.
Well, Yolanda, you're going to stay with us after our break. And Claire, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Claire Jefferson Glipa is the mother of a 4.5-year-old child and a toddler, and she's a former teacher. She lives in Riverside, California, and Yolanda Moses is Vice Provost for Diversity and Conflict Resolution at the University of California at Riverside. After the break, we're going to ask Yolanda about a big project she's working on. And next on News and Notes, more tips on how to talk to children about race, and our very own Tony Cox brings us the latest from the NBA Finals with New York Times columnist Bill Roden.
We
I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. We've been talking about how kids come to terms with race and how that understanding shapes their lives. We're back with Yolanda Moses. She is Vice Provost for Diversity and Conflict Resolution and Professor of Anthropology at the University of California at Riverside. Welcome back.
Thank you.
So you're on the advisory board of a project called Race, Are We So Different?
Yes.
So what's the goal of that? How does it work?
Well, the goal of this project is to raise a level of conversation in this country about what race is and what race isn't. And we're doing this through a museum exhibit, a public website, and the development of educational materials for both teachers and families to talk about race. And all of this information is free to the public, and we hope to get people to understand that race is a concept that is not biological, but it's cultural.
So that in and of itself, we mentioned that earlier in the show, but I'm sure we're going to get letters. People, you know, get into the is this just biological versus is this cultural versus is this hybrid? Why do you say it's cultural?
Well, it's cultural because it is not a reality in the natural world. There's no such thing as humans. Humans cannot be divided into races because we are one species. So it's not a biological fact. But these hierarchies, social hierarchies, have been constructed that are highly racialized so that we have an artificial kind of social and cultural construction of what race is and who is raced and who is at the top of the race heap and who's at the bottom of the race heap. And as a result of that, we also have racism and racist institutions that are embedded in our everyday life. And so we unlock those as well.
Do you think it's confusing to kids to say, okay, this is a construct and we invented it as human beings, and then also go into the history of racism and discrimination? Do you think that they get that?
Yes, I do think they get that. And as the result, the reason I know that is because this exhibit has been traveling. We're on the sixth city right now, and the exhibit has a five-year run around the museums around the country. And young people are so engaged in the interactive toys and the interactive features of the exhibit that we know they're engaged and we know they're curious and they're asking questions. So I think we do them a disservice if we think they can't grasp those ideas. We have to do it at a level that they can understand, but yes, they can.
Do you ever get parents who say, well, I don't really like the way you're approaching this. I don't believe that the way you're approaching this is the best way for my child, even if they brought their kids or they've had their kids kind of come on a field trip?
We've had very few people who have said that. We have people who have left suggestions of how we can do things better, which we really want. But the focus groups that we conducted with parents before, as we were putting this exhibit together at school sites around the country, it was very clear they were hungry for us to do something that would allow them to help explain to their children why people look different, what the concept of race is, and more importantly, how people of all different backgrounds can get along in the school site.
Give me a very concrete example of something that you have in the exhibit. Describe to us one thing.
We have a wheel, color wheel, and we ask students to find their color on the color wheel. And this is a place where we talk about the history of skin color and why people have different skin color. And it has a lot to do with how humans migrated out of Africa over the, you know, past 20,000, 50,000 years. Anyway, they find themselves, and then they look at ranges of people from around the world who look like them. And it's a big aha moment.
Do you think that we're at a moment where there are some changes going on about the way that we view race? I mean, obviously, on our show, we talk a lot about race, both in the social issues, the legal issues, and people's perceptions. Do you think we're having a culture shift at this moment?
I do. And there was a series that was done on PBS. I can't remember which reporter. I think it was Andrea Mitchell, I'm not sure, where she did a lot of interviews with Generation Next. And these are the young people in our society who are just going into high school And these are young people who have totally different ideas about race than we do and how they can get along with each other. But what was missing was concrete information, science and history and an understanding of social structure so that they could have these conversations. So part of what I'm excited about is this is a project that gives young people who are already thinking about bridging gaps and already thinking about bridging divides of culture and race to have tools to talk about this in ways that our generation did not.
Yolanda, thank you so much.
You are welcome.
Yolanda Moses is on the advisory board of a project called Race, Are We So Different? She's also vice provost for diversity and conflict resolution at the University of California at Riverside. Now we've got an update on hot topics in sports with our own Tony Cox. Hey, Tony.
Hey, Farai. You know, we have the NBA Finals, of course, and to go along with that, an NBA scandal. We have Tiger back on the prowl and the big 600 for the little Griffey Jr. that could. Here to help us break it all down is New York Times sports columnist Bill Roden, who is actually here in studio with me for the first time. Hey, bro.
With the great Tony Cox.
It's so nice to hear and see you all at the same time. So let's get right into the scandal talk. Here's the quick background. Former referee Tim Donaghy was disgraced after he admitted to betting on games, even some that he officiated, and he's about to be sentenced next month. Now, he filed a letter in federal court claiming that unnamed league officials plotted with other referees to favor teams that got the biggest TV ratings. Of course, the LA Lakers during the Shaq and Kobe days. Now, one of the examples Donaghy cited was the 2002 playoffs between the Lakers and the Kings, Sacramento Kings, a game in which the Lakers shot 27 free throws in the fourth quarter and went on to win in seven games, a game that still leaves a very bitter taste in the mouths of Kings fans. So reaction to this latest charge by this referee has been, well, let's start with you. What has been the reaction from your standpoint?
Well, you know, Tony, and I think within the NBA and the NBA circle, it's been denial. Oh no, it can't happen. But the reality is that this is something that people have been talking about from my wife for like years. Well, you know, it's going to go seven games, but it's almost become almost as not that anybody's angry. It's kind of an accepted thing. And the worst thing about this scandal, from the NBA's point of view, the NBA deals with image and the perception, and you know, the perception is worse than the reality. And David Stern, who's the commissioner of the NBA, is normally just kind of blows this off and that kind of stuff. And this is going to stick.
Think it's going to stick? You know what? I'm reminded of, and I want to get your thought on this. Remember in the steroid controversy in baseball when mm-hmm. Jose Canseco wrote the book and everybody was like, Canseco's crazy. He's this. Right. And now Donaghy, even though he's maybe going to jail for what he did, people are saying, well, he's a felon. You know, how can you believe felons can't tell the truth? Right. How can you believe a convicted felon?
Right.
And yet this thing's not going away.
Yeah, and you're right. Canseco wrote the book, and he said, yeah, I may be slimy, but that's why I know who was down there with me. You know, so you're not going to be able to laugh this off because, you know, where there's smoke, there's fire. And what the NBA has got to do is the first thing I got to do is move the NBA referees out of the NBA office.
Well, you know, Commissioner Stern yesterday said, because Phil Jackson was the one who suggested that.
Right.
He said he's crazy.
Who's crazy?
The commissioner said that idea is crazy.
Yeah, I know, but I'm just saying, commissioner, who's crazy? You're the one with the problem. And if you keep them there, you know what it's going to be like? It's going to be like the Harlem Globetrotters and the Washington Nationals. You know how the Globetrotters carry their own opponents with them just so they could get the show? Well, that's just what this is going to be like. We're going to carry our own officials, so whenever we need to make some adjustments, we'll have them right there in our office. And listen, I think we're calling to lose too many fouls this year.
Let me play devil's advocate. Last question on NBA before we move on. Mm-hmm. The idea is to make money in ratings for the league, which the league is doing. Game 3, this dream matchup, conspiracy or not, between the Lakers and the Celtics, Game 3, highest-rated game since 2004.
So, Tony, you answer the question with the premise. The idea is make money and rating. And whenever you get money and ratings involved, anything could happen. Remember, we all grew up on the playground playing pickup basketball. I never played in the game where they were officials. There was a core honesty that's in competition among people who just want to play. It's when all this other stuff starts getting involved that you begin to compromise the spirit and the essence of the game. And if it's about ratings and money, then there's your game, Commissioner.
So are you enjoying covering Celtics and Lakers? I know that's why you're out here in L.A. You're going to the game tonight.
I'm not here to be here. You didn't know? No, it's great drama. It's really, to me, this is the highest form of competition, which is why this controversy has to be dealt with. This is the greatest series, two great rivals, and I think this may end up being a classic series if we can get beyond this controversy. Because, Tony, this is not going away.
All right. Talking about ratings and things that happen, you know, just down the road from us, the U.S. Open kicked off today. And here's the interesting thing to me. I want to get your thoughts about it because paired together today, the number one player in the world, Tiger Woods, the number two player in the world, Phil Mickelson, the number three player in the world, Aaron Scott, all playing together. Is this just for the TV ratings for golf? Does golf need that?
Yes. This is for ratings. The problem is that Tiger is not right. I mean, Tiger is just coming off of surgery. And in a way, this is kind of the road is paved for Mickelson to win this. But the golf's greatest nightmare is when Tiger Woods suddenly, for some reason, can't play or is not the great Tiger Woods, because once that happens, golf just becomes
what it was before he played,
which is just golf. And there's, you're going to hear this big click. The people are going to watch it or who? The people who really like golf. But people watching now want to see Tiger be great.
Can he do it, though? How serious was this injury? Because I understood that until yesterday, he hadn't walked,
If you've ever had, and I've had arthroscopic surgery just months ago.
Okay.
If you've had that kind of stuff, it takes you a while. It takes you a while, and everybody is gunning for him. We saw it down at Augusta. Everybody who's playing, all these golfers who do nothing but think golf, are aiming at Tiger. And it's one thing when you're healthy and 100%. Now he doesn't know how he's going to react, because this is the first time being under this kind of pressure in a pressurized situation. Now they put him in this great threesome. So,
well, he's won twice down there, and now he's got Phil Mickelson, and that's his hometown court, so to speak.
Yeah, listen, if Tiger is as great as we all say he is, he's going to win. You know, it's going to be very hard, because he's been injured. He's never been injured like this before, so he doesn't know.
Talking about greatness, let's end our segment with you. And it's so good, I can't get over just looking at you while we're talking. Ken Griffey Jr., 600 home runs. Here's what his coach had to say about him, Dusty Baker. Quote, there is no cloud of suspicion over his head. Should he be held in higher esteem than he is, of course, and I'm sure he will be down the road. We got about 40 seconds. What do you think of that?
Griffey is a great guy. You know, just like Joe Frazier had come along in Ali's era, it's his misfortune, Griffey's misfortune, to come around in the Barry Bonds era. And also, he had the misfortune to just be hurt. If you total up all the games that he missed, he's missed almost about two seasons.
Yeah, that's true.
And part of what we do is basically you got to show up. You got to find a way to stay on the field. But great guy, great athlete, but I think that when we look at his career, it'll be, darn, what could he have done?
I can't believe he's actually been in Major League Baseball 20 years,
that's right.
38 years old, little Kenny Griffey Jr. Bill Roden, it's great to have you here. You're welcome to come to L.A. anytime.
Hey, man, I love it. This is great.
All right, thank you.
That was NPR's Tony Cox talking with New York Times sports columnist Bill Roden, who's fabulous, and I'm excited to see. Roden is the author of Third and a Mile, The Trials and Triumphs of the Black Quarterback. And now it's letter time. Our editor, Sasha Woodruff, is here with me. Hey, Sasha.
Hey, Fry. How are you?
Absolutely fabulous. So what are folks saying this week?
Well, as you know, we've been doing a lot of coverage about what it means to have the first African-American candidate with a viable shot at winning the White House. On Tuesday, we spoke to Reverend Al Sharpton about how black leaders are passing down the torch to a new generation.
Christine Maitland in Toronto, Canada, wrote us this. I must express my surprise at your interview with Reverend Al Sharpton. Given all the times that he had gotten himself into trouble and put his foot in his mouth, it was a pleasure to see why the Reverend is still very much a part of the picture. His discussion of black leadership in the U.S. was brilliant. I think that teachers should play this discussion in the classroom so that students get a better understanding what passing the torch ought to mean.
Jameela Moore also listened that day, but she took issue with the use of the label, the hip-hop generation. She wrote, "While I recognize the influence of hip-hop on my generation, I feel that characterizing the generation as such obscures our differences or deviations from a standardized notion of who we are supposed to be. I personally feel that perhaps we need to look at other ways of classifying my generation of black Americans beyond hip-hop, as in many cases it does not accurately depict the plethora of influences and obstacles we have faced."
And then Janita Doba in Akron, Ohio, didn't like another classification we used for a segment we did on Obama and Latino voters. "I have grown more and more disturbed by the use of the words Latino or Hispanic, used in the same context as one would use when discussing a racial group. There is no such thing as Latino or Hispanic race. Spanish as a first language does not a race make. I could go on about the history of racial divisions in Panama, Brazil, and other Latin American and Central American nations, but my point is to impress upon you, members of the media, to end this practice of lumping all persons who happen to speak Spanish into some fictional racial group." Janita, thanks, and well, we actually did make that point on our show, but it's always good to have it reinforced.
And speaking of heritage, a few listeners took issue with how the media say Barack Obama is African American. Terry Ingram wrote us this: "Barack Obama is being incorrectly labeled African-American, which is a half description of his heritage. This misrepresents him and dishonors his family. The media, his campaign, and our country need to embrace the multiracial society in which we live and accurately identify people as biracial." And that's it for letters. Thank you for writing, and please keep yours coming.
To write us, just log on to npr.org and click on Contact Us. When you get there, you'll see lots of shows to choose from. Make sure you pick News and Notes when you write to us.
And be sure to tell us where you're writing from and how to pronounce your name.
Thanks, Sasha.
No problem.
That's our show for today. Thank you for sharing your time with us. To listen to the show or subscribe to our podcast, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. To join the conversation or sign up for our newsletter, visit our blog at nprnewsandviews.org. News and Notes was created by NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Tomorrow, we slice and dice the week's headlines on our Reporters Roundtable.